Today at Reader's Corner, Michael Mandelbaum, author of That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back.
You can start a business now and sell your products around the world more easily, more readily than ever before, and we need to train and educate and encourage people to do that. We are accustomed to living in a world in which blue-collar factory jobs can disappear or be sent overseas, but now we've entered a world in which that is true of white-collar jobs. The political parties, because they have drifted so far to the extremes over the last four decades, do not fully represent the country.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The optimism that has defined America since its founding is today being tested perhaps as never before. Recession, war, debt, gridlock, declining national self-esteem are among the challenges that are reflected in the polls, headlines, and our daily lives. In their new book, That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back, co-authors Michael Mandelbaum and Thomas Friedman provide a frank assessment of the country's dangerous lack of focus, discipline, collective spirit, and leadership. But they also argue that America's decline is far from inevitable and that rekindling its role as a beacon to the world is a matter of reawakening key values important to past generations. Today we are talking with Michael Mandelbaum about his fascinating book. He is the Christian A. Herder Professor of American Foreign Policy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and director of the university's American Foreign Policy Program. Dr. Mandelbaum teamed up with his friend and colleague Thomas Friedman, a New York Times columnist and three times Pulitzer Prize winner, to write That Used to Be Us. In the book, they argue that America's past successes were built on pillars that must again become national priorities if we are to regain our place in the world. Dr. Mandelbaum joins us today by phone from his offices at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Michael Mandelbaum, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Delighted to be with you.
As I read your book, I could see throughout it that it was appealing to the middle-of-the-road center of the spectrum. I'm not suggesting you don't want members of the Tea Party to buy your book and ingest every page of it, but the fact is your message is written for what at one point in the book you call that radical center. And in the middle of the book, if I can start there, you actually take a few pages to describe the voters, the citizens of today, and where they stand on that political spectrum. And it's particularly enlightening, in fact, when you look at what's going on around the country today, this primary season, where all the focus is, for the Republican candidates anyway, who can get farther to the right. It somewhat belies the fact that you have some interesting evidence pointing out that there still is this really healthy center where most Americans seem to find themselves. Could you share with us the research, some of the latest findings on that?
Sure. You've identified a crucial point in That Used to Be Us, and that is that the political parties, because they have drifted so far to the extremes over the last four decades, do not fully represent the country. There is, according to studies by political scientists such as Morris Fiorina at Stanford, a large middle, a large group of voters in the middle of the spectrum who are really not represented by either Republicans or Democrats. Now, in a two-party system, there is usually a pretty strong incentive for one party or the other to gravitate toward the center in order to pick up the voters in the middle. But that's a weaker and weaker impulse these days because of the changes in American society and American politics that we describe at some length in the book. That means that the candidates that the parties offer us don't really represent many of us, and that's why in one of the concluding chapters of That Used to Be Us, which we entitle Shock Therapy, we propose a way to shake up what we believe is a dysfunctional political system. And that way is an independent presidential candidate this year in 2012 who would represent what we see as the radical middle, who would propose the policies that we describe in That Used to Be Us, that we believe are necessary for American revival, and that the two political parties are, alas, so polarized that neither of them can offer these policies.
Well, let's pursue this a bit then. We'll come back to how your book kicks off. If we can develop this theme a bit, I found it interesting that more than once you quoted Alan Simpson of Wyoming, and you quoted Evan Bayh. Now, Evan Bayh, of course, is a Democrat from Indiana. Simpson, a retired congressman from Wyoming. Simpson was the co-chair of the committee that really tried to get spending under control, deal with the deficit. I assume that you do still believe there are a few left in the two parties that could provide this kind of national leadership you're suggesting in some kind of a third-party development.
We would like to think so, but you'll notice that the political leaders whom we quote in That Used to Be Us, and Senator Simpson, whom both Tom Friedman and I know, and who's a wonderful person and former public servant, and Senator Bayh, and also Senator Bob Bennett of Utah, another admirable public servant, these people are all retired. They feel liberated. They can say what they think because they're not in politics anymore, and you'll note that they left politics voluntarily and involuntarily because they just found it so frustrating. Senator Bennett of Utah, who is a very conservative Republican, but also somebody who is interested in solving the nation's problems and a very effective and knowledgeable legislator, was defeated for renomination in 2010 in Utah, a very conservative state. Now, that was something of an aberration. In Utah, they don't have a primary, they have a caucus, so only the most dedicated and, alas, in this case, ideologically extreme people show up, and it was the energy of the Tea Party that ousted probably the most effective and serious conservative legislator in Washington. So there are still very able people in public life, but the tenor of public life and the structure of our party system discourages them from staying in public life, and when they are in public life, blocks them from taking the steps that they know very well are important for America's future.
Now, some would argue when you start talking about a third party that third parties are never successful in American history. They can't get elected. So why waste our time? You and Tom Friedman have some very interesting historical examples of where third parties, maybe they didn't get elected, but they sure did make a difference.
Yes, that's a very important point in our political prescription. First of all, we're not recommending a third party, that we don't expect a party to be formed and to persist after the 2012 presidential election, although ultimately that might happen. We're talking about an independent candidacy, and the point about an independent candidate for president is that he or she does not have to win in order to be successful. It's overwhelmingly likely that even the most attractive independent candidate for president would not become president, but if such a candidate did well, if such a candidate got about 20% of the popular vote, and remember that Ross Perot got 19% in 1992, that could well have a galvanizing effect on our politics and government. The reason is that such a candidate would be positioned in the middle of the political spectrum between Republicans and Democrats. This would not be like Ralph Nader or Pat Buchanan, who were on the flanks. And when the two parties see that there is 20% of the electorate up for grabs and that that 20% of the electorate is available to both parties, each party will have a powerful incentive to try to attract those voters to its own camp in order to win elections in the future. And that would mean co-opting some of the issues on which the independent candidate ran. Now, there's a logic to that. And as you point out, there is also some history. Three times in the 20th century, an independent candidate did unusually well. In 1992, it was Ross Perot. In 1968, George Wallace. In 1912, Theodore Roosevelt, running as the Bull Moose candidate rather than as a Republican. None of these three candidates was elected president, but each of them did well enough so that the candidate who was elected adopted part of the independent candidate's platform as part of his governing agenda. That was true of Bill Clinton in 1993, of Richard Nixon in 1969, and of Woodrow Wilson in 1913. And we think that the time is ripe for a similar independent candidate in 2012, and such a candidate could have a similar salutary effect on American politics. And let me note, most importantly, that we are in favor of such a candidate, not because we think there ought to be three or four or five parties, but because we believe that the American political system is stuck and is not doing the things that we as Americans need to move forward in the 21st century. So our interest in an independent candidate is in the service of a particular agenda that is set out in the preceding chapters of That Used to Be Us.
So let's back up then to the beginning of the book and talk a little bit about the challenges America faces, globalization in particular. And, of course, that's the reason why this increasing competitiveness that we find across the globe is challenging us more than ever before, especially our educational system. But back in 2004 or 5, whatever it was, Thomas Friedman wrote the book The World is Flat. And I don't think there's many folks out there who don't keep up with popular opinion, who don't understand that he was writing and informing us about the fact that the tech revolution is leveling the global economic playing field, and we better figure out a way to do something about it. But now in your book, you update that and say, sorry, but we're going to have to put a flat world 2.0 in its newest version before you. What happened in the meantime that has you in this book announcing a newer version of the flat world?
Well, as you say, we structure the book around our four major challenges: globalization, the information technology revolution, deficits and debt, and energy and its impact on climate. Of these, the first two, that is globalization and the IT revolution, have merged to transform the global economy, the American economy, the world of work. And that presents the most immediate challenge to Americans. And that challenge gets more formidable by the day because information technology has kept on evolving. When Tom Friedman, my co-author, wrote his book, The World is Flat, there was no such thing as Facebook. There was no such thing as Skype. There was no such thing as the Amazon.com cloud, things that have come into use since then and have accelerated the integration of the world and the evolution of the global economy. So things are moving very rapidly. That puts enormous pressure on every American job. We are accustomed to living in a world in which blue-collar factory jobs can disappear or be sent overseas. But now we've entered a world in which that is true of white-collar jobs, and not just ordinary office jobs, but jobs that require a lot of skill and a lot of education, jobs done by architects, engineers, doctors, lawyers, accountants, and one day even perhaps, God forbid, professors. Now, that puts enormous pressure on our education system, because our system of education is what prepares Americans for the working world of the 21st century. Our system of education, especially at the primary and secondary levels, although those of us involved in higher education cannot afford to be complacent, but especially at the lower levels of education, our system is not performing in the way we need to have it perform. And that's why over 25% of That Used to Be Us is about education and what we need to do. Education is our most important economic challenge, and because the American role in the world depends upon the strength and health of the American economy, American education is really our most important national security challenge in the 21st century.
Now, when you're in the middle of this discussion of the flat world 2.0, you use an example of a St. Louis company named Endosteam that is just amazingly organized and developed across the globe. I wonder if you could help us understand how that really serves as such a great example of what you're getting at when it comes to this combination of forces from globalization and the tech revolution.
Well, we think that if we do things properly, Endostim is the wave of the future. It's a small biotech company formed by a couple of entrepreneurs, and it represents what we hope will be the future in several ways. First, it takes advantage of one of the frontiers of economic advance based on research and development, in which the United States has historically been strong, although alas, we've fallen off a bit, and that is research and development. Second, it's a truly global company. It involves principals on three different continents who collaborate virtually over the internet. And third, it is relatively small. It's promising. It's not clear what its future will be. But even if it succeeds, it's not going to employ lots and lots of people the way our old firms did. We're not going to have more General Motors with huge plants around Detroit. We're not going to have more massive insurance companies employing hundreds of thousands of people. So we need dozens, hundreds, thousands of endostims to employ Americans and to employ them with wages that will sustain the American standard of living. That's why we devote so much attention to it.
I do have to wonder, when I hear you talk about the focus that you've placed in your book on education, and of course understand the reason why you would spend so much time talking about K-12, as somebody in the university business, I must say I wonder sometimes whether or not we today, at least in public higher education, have really utilized the tools of the tech revolution to the extent that we can. We'll be starting up our second semester here next week at Boise State, and students are, for the most part, going to be coming back to classes that are going to look very much like the classes I attended in the 1960s. And it does make one wonder whether maybe your next book has to spend a little bit more time talking about how we adapt higher education in America to this changing climate you've described in the book.
Well, none of us is immune from the impact of the technological revolution. I teach in a graduate school of international affairs that is part of the Johns Hopkins University, but located in Washington, D.C., not far from the White House. And when I started teaching there 20 years ago, no student had a personal computer. Today, everybody does. Today, I can post the assignments online. They can send me their papers via the internet, and I can correct them online and comment on them online. But you're right. In many ways, higher education looks the way it did when we started out. It's an open question to what extent technology will change that model. There's a lot of interest in distance learning, and because the school where I teach has campuses in Nanjing, China, and Bologna, Italy, we spend a lot of time teleconferencing with our far-flung colleagues, and that is very useful as well. But higher education and education itself is a kind of craft and has been since the days of the ancient Greeks, so it probably is going to change less rapidly than other endeavors, but in other kinds of businesses and other kinds of trades and crafts, the change has been rapid and it's probably only just begun.
You're listening to Michael Mandelbaum. He is the author of That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back. You talk about creative servers, describing the kind of worker employers need today. And you and Tom Friedman, I know, have spent countless hours interviewing employers, trying to get a feel for just what it is that is needed in the workplace today. Help us understand this concept of the creative server that you discuss in your book.
Well, one conclusion we reached is that everybody, no matter what his or her job, is going to have to be more creative to get and keep a well-paying job. Now, that means for some people inventing and reinventing their own jobs. It means inventing jobs that don't yet exist. It certainly means a lot more innovation and entrepreneurship. And incidentally, we believe that the merger of globalization and the information technology revolution, which have put such pressure on American jobs, also creates wide opportunity. We are at the beginning of a golden age of innovation and entrepreneurship. You can start a business now and sell your products around the world more easily, more readily than ever before, and we need to train and educate and encourage people to do that. But not everybody's going to be an entrepreneur. Not everybody's going to be a Steve Jobs or a Michael Dell or a Bill Gates. There are lots of jobs that are not tradable, where there is no foreign competition. You can't get your hair cut or your lawn mowed or get served in a restaurant from China. But even people who have those jobs are going to have to find ways to stand out. They're going to have to find ways to make themselves indispensable. They're going to have to find ways to add value. That's why we say that creativity need not and must not be confined to people in the high-tech sphere and people who compete with others in other countries. We're all going to have to be more creative.
You kicked off your book with a great little example of what it's like getting from Bethesda, Maryland, to your workplace when you have to use the metro and when you have to take an escalator. And you compared the experience in getting that escalator fixed with Tianjin, China, trying to put together a major conference center. That really grabbed me. I mean, if there's anything that made me read this book, when I managed to get through your frustration dealing with this little infrastructure issue that I'm sure any of us could recount in our daily lives across America, I thought, this is a book worth reading.
Well, thank you. That really touches on two major themes of the book. One is that infrastructure is crucial. In fact, we write about what we call the five-part formula for American economic success. It's a five-part partnership between the public and the private sector, which has been crucial for American economic growth from the very beginning of the Republic. In fact, we believe that the founding father of this formula was Alexander Hamilton, the man whose face graces our $10 bill and who was our first Secretary of the Treasury. And that formula has five parts, of which infrastructure is one. The others are education, research and development, a good immigration policy, and proper regulations. But infrastructure is crucial for American economic growth, and we are falling behind in modernizing our infrastructure. By the estimate of the American Society of Civil Engineers a couple of years ago, we are in arrears in upgrading our infrastructure to where it should be to provide economic growth by $2.2 trillion. So we should be spending much more on infrastructure. And this point came home to us when my co-author visited a huge conference center in China, size of the Pentagon, built really in only 8 months, remarkable example of modern technology and rapid construction, and then came home, and we were talking on the phone, and my wife got on the phone as Tom was describing this conference center to me, and she said, "Have you been in our local Bethesda metro stop lately?" And he knew exactly what we were talking about. One of the smaller escalators in this relatively new metro system, for which the whole country paid since it's in our nation's capital, had been out of order for fully 6 months. And this was only 21 steps. The Chinese could build a Pentagon-sized conference center, state-of-the-art, in 8 months, and we couldn't repair one tiny escalator in six. And that brought home to us just how far behind we are in upgrading our infrastructure. Now, it also made a second point, and that is what you might call, among some people, China envy. There is a sense in the country that the Chinese are speeding ahead and we're falling behind and they're going to displace us. Our point here is not that we should imitate China, that we need a Chinese-style system. It's not even that China is destined to be the economic leader of the 21st century. In fact, we don't believe that. China has plenty of problems and we have great potential. But people who worry about Chinese competition, we believe, are actually worrying about America. Many people see in China the traits as a nation that we used to have, but that we seem to have lost. And that, we think, is to some extent, not completely, but to some extent, an accurate perception. But the traits that we admire in China, and of course not every aspect of China is admirable by any means, but the traits that we admire in China are ones that are part of the American past. And we argue that in order to secure the future, we have to go back to what made us a great nation. That's the reason that a book about the American future has a backward-looking title, That Used to Be Us.
You mentioned immigration when you were listing some of the formulas, and I want to make sure that we clarify what you're talking about. This is not necessarily the illegal immigration issue, which so many Western states are contending. You're talking about the H-1B visa and our ability to bring the best and the brightest in from other parts of the world. Could you help our listeners understand that?
You're exactly right. Historically, at least for most of our history, America has been very good at attracting and retaining what we call high IQ risk takers, people who came to the United States from other countries and put their energies and their skills and their talents and their knowledge to work in ways that benefited the whole country. These are people who discovered new things or who created new products or who started new businesses. And in fact, that's still going on. According to one survey I saw, fully half of the new businesses created in Silicon Valley are started by people born in other countries, principally India and China. So these high IQ risk takers have been crucial to American success, and yet our immigration system is a mess, and we have not been able to modify it in order to admit more of those people, people who are crucial for economic growth, which is crucial, the single most crucial thing for America's future. Now, one of the reasons the immigration system is so messed up and paralyzed is the issue of illegal immigration, and that's an important issue. We don't downplay that. It's important to resolve it, but the deadlock over illegal immigration has prevented us from taking steps that everybody concerned with the issue understands is necessary for our future. It's another way in which the political system is paralyzed to the detriment of America's future.
You call yourselves frustrated optimists. And when you finish reading this book, Michael, there are moments when you certainly get frustrated, and perhaps there's a little bit more frustration than optimism, given the way you stack up these incredible challenges before us and some of what's going on around us right now in the town you're living and working in doesn't hold out a lot of hope. Give us just a kernel of your thoughts when it comes to why we have to remain optimistic and what's going to get us there.
Well, the way we put this is that if you want to be optimistic about America, stand on your head, because the country looks a lot better from the bottom up than from the top down. There are lots of people all over the country, I'm sure many in Boise, who are energetic entrepreneurs, who are starting things, who are discovering things, who are organizing things. I'm sure that at your university, you've got a lot of impressive things besides the football team, which is pretty impressive. And that's true all over the country. There are people who, as we say in the title of our chapter, just didn't get the word. They didn't get the word that America is supposed to be finished, that they're supposed to be depressed, that gridlock rules the day. We still have the kind of energy, the kind of drive, the kind of creativity that has always served to make America a great country. What we need to do is foster more of it and create structures in which it can find appropriate expression. We need to stop stifling it. And if we can do that, then we can once again be the country that used to be us.
Well, that's a really good message for this town, because this is a tech economy here in Boise, Idaho, and Boise State University is a STEM discipline university, and we serve not only large, mature companies like HP and Micron Technology, but also the secondary industries that have grown up around them. And I did enjoy that chapter, and I think it's really important for our listeners to take a look at the book from any number of vantage points. But when you delve into that chapter and describe some of the people that are making a difference, I think it shows you that out there in the real world, in spite of the gridlock in Washington, we are making progress. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, so I do urge our listeners to get out there and get a copy of That Used to Be Us by Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It's been my pleasure.
Next week, Mark Adams, author of Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time. The engineer for today's show is Dustin Verberg, research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.